Welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast, where we amplify the stories of regular people practicing anti-racism in their everyday lives. Every single one of us has the ability to create real and meaningful change right where we are. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I've got the stories to prove it. I can't wait to introduce you to these people, these change leaders, people who saw a need and decided to take action. To me, this is so inspiring, showing the powerful idea of everyday activism. I hope that you take away at least some small inspiration and use it to act and create more good in your world too. Let's get started, y'all. Hello and welcome to the Inclusion First Podcast. I'm your host, Carrie Sawyer, and I am so excited that you are here today. We are going to have a fantastic conversation. My guest today, I think if I had to describe her in one word, it would be badass. I got the opportunity to work with her on a Black History Month project for one of our local community colleges. And although she is not affiliated with community college, she is a director. And so we were doing this like cross-industry discussion on history, anti-racism, and film. And that is her area. She's a director. She's a producer. She is incredible. And so let me read you all of her receipts and you can see how amazing she is too. Now, Christine Swanson is our guest for this episode of the Inclusion First Podcast, and Christine is a visionary writer-director from Detroit, Michigan, and she most recently directed the record-breaking smash hit film, The Clark Sisters, First Ladies of Gospel, which was 2020's Best Movie Award recipient from the African American Film Critics Association, and recently nominated for a Critics' Choice Award for the Best Movie Made for Television. Her other celebrated movie credits include All About You, The Mickey Howard Story, and For the Love of Ruth, for which she earned an NAACP Image Award nomination for Outstanding Director in a Television Motion Picture. Now, currently, Christine is attached to write and direct the upcoming feature film inspired by the life of criminal justice reform advocate Kemba Smith. She will also serve as a co-producer on that film. Christine received her Master's of Fine Arts degree in film from New York University Tisch School of the Arts and her Bachelor of the Arts from the University of Notre Dame. Christine also directed an episode of Chicago PD, and that episode won the award for the best episode of that season, and it is amazing. So please check out Christine Swanson on IMDb and get ready to have an incredible conversation with her here today. Hi, Christine. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Awesome. So I'm really excited to have this conversation with you. You've gotten to, we've gotten to talk through the Inclusion First Project and Anti-Racism for Allies, and I really appreciate your perspective and also just the field that you're in, like being a director and all the things that you do are just really fascinating to me. So I'm excited to dig in a little bit more and talk a bit about, starting off with like activism. And the first question that I have is, what does it mean to you to be an activist in 2021?
Well, in many ways, I feel that I'm grounded and rooted in like the type of upbringing that I had. And I was raised primarily by my great aunt, who was 65 years old, roughly at the time, a Black woman from Mississippi who was a domestic worker in Detroit, Michigan, and circumstances just created an environment where my single Black dad ended up living with her, and she essentially was my my primary caregiver. And I think about women like her and in terms of the vast greatness of the history of our civil rights movement. And I don't think she was one of those marching types, you know, but deeply spiritual and very pro-Black in her own way. Mm-hmm. But activism I saw when she took in a child who was not her own and made it a point to raise me as if I were. Mm. So I look at that and I'm constantly challenged by the idea of the kindness of strangers. And granted, she was my blood relative, but she was not even my grandmother. She was my grandmother's sister.
Wow.
Making her my great aunt. And I think of that and I think like activism means to me caring for things and others that are not specifically or directly related to you, but your contribution or your participation in the well-being of others very much defines your humanity. And that's kind of like how I see things. So activism is the definition of it is greater and bigger than what's most popular about activism. So I come from a community of people who live, breathe, and walk activism on a daily basis. There are just no cameras in front of them. There are just no reporters in front of them. And it may not be for big issues, you know, but the everyday issues that really matter in terms of the contribution to making a world a better place and helping others to realize their own humanity to their fullest potential. So that to me is activism, and that can happen on a small level every single day, all day, every day.
I love that. And I love this idea of, you know, the kindness of strangers and the impact that you can have on people, regardless of whether it's large or small in a moment or over a lifetime. And one of the reasons why we are here talking about, you know, activism and allyship and anti-racism is because I really want this project to make it clear that it's accessible to everyone. Like this idea of everyday activism, everyday anti-racism, not just that you're doing something every day, but that it is just as normal as like brushing your teeth, like, you know, getting up and having a conversation. It's something that you can fit into your day because it's just a natural thing. And I think the way that you described it is a really kind of beautiful parallel to that, because it can be anything. It can happen in any moment, and you don't have to be out pounding the pavement. You don't have to run for governor or mayor or president. It doesn't have to be these grandiose actions. It really is looking around you in your life and seeing where you can make a difference, seeing where you can help people who need help or uplift or amplify, whatever that is, and being aware and being in that mindset. And I think that really is the shift that people are making, but need to continue to make is how do we shift that mindset so that we're seeing these opportunities where a lot of people once, you know, were blind or apathetic or uninterested in taking, you know, taking that action. Mm-hmm.
It's also like, I think it's become commonplace today, like to partake in activism. In a way that, again, where there are spotlights and cameras, and there's this danger of being a for-profit activist as opposed to being an everyday activist. And there is a great distinction. But I'm not sure how mad I am with anyone who wants to do things to make the world better. It's just suspect when they do it for a paycheck. you know, so is life.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely touches on this idea of performative allyship, performative activism, and, you know, where you're doing it solely for that reason. And really it's shallow, both in your involvement and passion for it, but also in the impact. Honestly, when you're, you know, when it's performative, you're not making an impact, right? So
well, it just muddies the water in a lot of different ways, because it's interesting because I would, as opposed to saying or subscribing to anti-racism, I have just lived and experienced a life where it's really anti-blackness that has been an issue now more so than ever. even in light of the fact that we've had a Black president, you know, I think it's actually worse. And there's a difference when you're talking about anti-Blackness, because anti-racism can encompass, like right now, it's like the anti-Asian hate, right? Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is, like, we can all be anti-racism, but Asians can also be anti-Black.
Right.
And clearly, I'm Blasian. I'm half Korean, half Black. So it's funny, like, I understand the struggle on both sides, and I'm really disturbed by, you know, the anti-Asian hate that I'm seeing, but I'm not surprised by it. And ironically, like, Asian people are surprised by it. And the sad thing is, as we are becoming I feel like, you know, volatile and suspicious and territorial in our culture. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants what's theirs, and they don't want to give up anything. Right. And what's happening is, you know, in light of discussions about white privilege and really what that is and what that affords, the conversations also need to be had about what it means to dismantle white privilege and what that looks like. And what that looks like is giving up a lot. Like, you have to give up a lot that you just got because of white racism. I mean, white racism, white privilege, systemic racism. And what that looks like is some of this stuff is not yours. It never was.
Sure. Absolutely.
And properly dealing with what that looks like, if we were to really dismantle things, it means like giving up a lot of things that you thought was yours and you thought you were comfortable having. So nobody wants to do that. For 400 years, we've lived like this. We've had this. We don't want to give that up. Thus, the insurrection on January. Nobody wanted to give anything up, even if it was a fair election and democratically run. It doesn't matter. If we lose, then it wasn't democratic, and nothing could be further from the truth. So what's happening now, as people are forced to look at what they have to give up, it's like they're looking around and saying, who else can I hate? I hate these people. I don't want to give up anything to these people. And the history of these people, you know, is that, you know, if I can be a quiet and hardworking model immigrant society and culture, then I can assimilate into whiteness in a way that benefits me and mine. Mm-hmm. Well, they ain't trying to give up anything to anybody, right? So thus this anti-Asian kind of hate. And everybody on the Asian side are like, well, we need allies. We need Black folks to stand up for us. But the problem is, you have not dealt with your anti-Blackness. See, Black people have always stood up for everybody who's been, like, you know, discriminated against.
Yeah, we're like, yo, we get that. We get that.
Falls under the umbrella and the purview of our civil rights struggle. But the problem is that historically, over time, you know, we want to deal with racism, but specifically the problem is anti-Blackness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for people who don't know what anti-Blackness is, Christine, how would you explain that?
It's kind of like a really screwed up way of looking at life in a way where, you know, whites are on top, then other mixed races, other cultures and things and people are next. And at the very bottom are Black people. As long as they stay at the bottom, that everybody above them are okay. But the minute the Black people who are at the very bottom say, hey, we want more, you know, and this is not right, and we're addressing this, it starts to become like a kind of like a tense situation where, you know, we have to keep them down so we feel better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this idea of proximity to whiteness, right? Like, and emulating whiteness as well. So when white people get uncomfortable because they're feeling they have to give up something, like, okay, well that's the model, right? Well, and then just fill in the, you know, the ethnic group. Whoa, we don't want to give up anything either. Cause that's how this works. Mm-hmm. We can't disrupt this whole model because we've assimilated ourselves gotten as close to whiteness as we can, which gives us as much access as we can get. And we feel that if we give anything up, we're going to have less, and we don't want to be in the bottom either.
Right. And the proximity to whiteness requires that you adopt ideas of anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And without calling it that, you know, it is you're functioning in that space, and it's that's the problem to me. Like, that, even anti-racism, I get that, but it doesn't address specifically the kind of things that Black people have to deal with when you're dealing with all kinds of other ethnicities as well. You know, other ethnicities do well by making sure Black people stay on the bottom. They benefit from that too. Immigrants mm-hmm. benefit from that, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's a systemic issue in America. That's a specific, I think, American problem, and racism is around the world, but America is anti-blackness, you know, and that has its own kind of remedy that most people who aren't Black don't want to deal with.
Yeah, I can't think of how many friends that I have who aren't Black, who aren't white, who had like the dating rule, like, you can bring home this race and this race and this race, but don't you dare bring home a Black person. I mean, like, why do we get the, why are we the short end of the stick on this? Like, why?
I'm sorry, but I don't want to go home to you, so don't worry about it.
Right, though?
It's like, that's the thing. It's the idea that we don't want what you have. We want to be left alone to do what we do, with the greatness that we always apply to what we do, mm-hmm. and left alone to do it. And then what happens is y'all end up coming co-opting us, you know? our culture, our style, our language,
our features, our
you know, so. We were doing fine anyway. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, have you read Me and White Supremacy by Ijeoma Oluo?
No, I have not.
That book is very powerful. It is written primarily for a white audience, but there's so much that people of color can get from it as well, because there's a big part of it that is about anti-Blackness and really breaking it down and asking questions that you can understand what it looks like, just not in the world, but how you think in a way that is absolutely anti-Black. And it's not just other people. We Black people are anti-Black as well. We all have so much work to do.
We have our own internal issues, you know, and like mm-hmm. In terms of anti-Blackness within our own community, it's we live in a culture that is founded on systemic racism, that we find ourselves in situations where we're dealing with self-hate, and it's directly tied to like the culture that we live in that makes it seem like we're the worst. And the irony of it is we're not, you know, and history has shown that we rise against tremendous adversity and
over and over again,
and have shown a level of success to me that is unmatched by any oppressed group of people in all of history, you know. And there's that greatness within us that is, I would want to suppress that too if I was, you know, anti-Black, you know?
Trying to keep the system going for sure, because. Yeah,
but the anti-Blackness that happens among Blacks is like, you deal with immigrant Blacks who come here. And again, they can subscribe to a status quo as long as they subscribe to anti-Blackness, which keeps foundational Black Americans on the bottom. Mm-hmm. Those foundational Black Americans are descendants of slaves. So as long as we keep them Negroes where they are, like, we're not like them. So that language, we're not like them. You can look like them, but we're not like them is really code for, I subscribe to anti-Blackness too, because it allows me to live a life that has a close proximity to whiteness, and for my own livelihood, that's the direction I need to go in, you know. So it's complicated, you know, and I love having a dialogue about it, because I think it gets muddied sometimes in our culture, because people think they're so woke when they are the perpetrators of anti-Blackness, anti-racism, sexism, you know, all of that, you know?
Mm-hmm. I kind of hate that word now, woke. I don't know. It just, like,
You know what? It's another Black language thing
that was appropriated. Yes.
Yes. It's been adopted. And that's why you hate hearing it. But I'm sorry. It's very much part of my vernacular, because it comes from my folks.
No. I mean, I totally get it. The reason why I hate it is because of the misuse of it, and the use of it by people who don't really understand what it means, and how the definition has changed based on who's using it and how they're using
it. Mindful of them, why I don't give people space to be irritated by them.
Hmm.
That's like wasting too much of my time.
For sure.
So that's what I'm saying. When I speak it, and it doesn't bother me that other people misappropriate it, because I don't even hear it. Honestly, I don't hear it when people are like, you know, because I don't engage in a lot of those conversations, because why would I? Why would I give that space? So to keep, like, healthy mentally, it's like we have to not give everybody space in the pursuit of peace, in the pursuit of anti-racism. I feel like we should flip the script, and it should be that we have to self-care and have these dialogues with each other, you know? And then when time permits, it's like, okay, let's engage in a macro way. But that's not where I'm spending the majority of my time.
Hmm. I really like this idea. So I'm going to kind of pull on this string a little bit. Like, thinking about activism in how we're choosing to engage in these dialogues and what that looks like, who we're doing it with, how we're doing it as well. With the Inclusion First Project and all the questions, we collected like over 600 questions on anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And one of the top categories was people wanting to talk about race in order to convince other people that they were wrong or racist, or have these more confrontational discussions. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm hearing you saying is that is not a good use of time. And I would love for you to say more about that.
Yeah. See, I find it more useful for me and my personal growth to have conversations with my people.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and finding ways to dissect like what's happening in the culture, and like, really, what does that mean? That's kind of like where I honed in on anti-Blackness. Is actually not a personal conversation, but in listening to people who specialize in that kind of language, and like, and they're speaking to on YouTube, no less, and they're talking to me, they're talking to other Black people, you know, and I find those kinds of conversations very enriching, because it keeps us sharp in terms of what the real problems are. See, and then when you have conversations where everybody gets to participate, everybody doesn't come to the table with the same experiences and perspective. There is a place for that, and I respect that, and I enjoy actively participating in those kind of conversations. I just don't give it that much space. Because what I find that I'm doing is I'm constantly teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm and my thing is, like, y'all are as grown as I am. And you don't know what anti-Blackness is. You don't know what systemic racism has done historically to Black people, Black institutions, Black communities, and Black history. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about ways to massage your guilt, or how about this, your ignorance, mm-hmm. or do we really want to talk about how complicit you are? Do we want to talk about how intentionally or unintentionally you are blind to issues that affect other people and your lack of activism, and how that is perpetuating problems, you know? And it took you 40 years to figure out that, oh my gosh, I think I'm racist. How is that my problem?
Yeah.
How is that my problem? But we want to continue these conversations. Then you want to get the expert Black person on these issues to come and teach. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm tired. Like, I'm tired. Like, if you don't know that, if you say to me that, oh, he shouldn't have resisted arrest, or else he wouldn't have died. If you can say that with a straight face, we have nothing to talk about. We have nothing to talk about. And I cannot give you any more energy, because I'm just trying to make it from day to day. And I'm just trying to figure out how to make sense of this in light of the fact that I have 3 Black sons and a Black husband. And every time they want to go out, like at night, I'm begging them not to. And hey, let's invite your friends home here, you know, or I'm always thinking of other routes to not expose them to the streets that they should be protected in by the people who took oaths to protect and serve. And I'm trying to figure out ways to divert their interactions as much as possible. Or when my son gets pulled over for a traffic violation, the first thing I'm thinking is, oh my God, please let him say and do the right things so it does not escalate. That's the first thing I think of. And it just happened. My son got a ticket and
oh, wow.
He calls me and he's like, where's the registration? And I'm like, it's in the car, no? He's like, no, I can't find it. It was like a new car. So actually it was taped to the front window. And I didn't realize that. And I'm like, well, just keep the phone on speaker so I can hear everything. And long story short, when it was done and said, he was like, well, you know, thankfully she was a female cop. And I'm thinking like, thankfully why? I know why. I know what he meant.
Yeah.
That he felt like because she was a female cop, that maybe he had more of a chance not to end up dead. And this is my son who's a sophomore at NYU, but that doesn't mean anything when you're pulled over by a cop and we know the history of what these cops can do. So I don't want to talk about why. You don't understand why he wouldn't just, you know, submit. Because you don't see our humanity in the way that we live it. So I don't know that it's my responsibility or job to teach you. If you don't want to learn yourself, and if you don't know already, then I'm sorry. I'm too busy protecting my own children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the emotional Olympics and labor of even having to rationalize through everything that you just shared, Christine. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we've been saying is when a person of color, when a Black person tells you their experience, like, believe it. I feel like people don't believe it. Like, oh yeah, that's just for those people or that kind of thing. It's for all of us. Every single person with brown skin, every Black man, woman, and child. We have this experience for a mundane thing like registration, taillight out, et cetera, et cetera. Like, this is the terror and the weight that that creates.
I teach each of my kids and my sons, because they're the ones in driving ages. I'm like, if you ever get pulled over for a ticket, take the ticket. I don't care how much it is. I said, we can pay for the ticket and we can fight the ticket. You do not question the ticket. Just even if you're in the right and they're wrong, take the ticket.
We're just trying to get you out of there alive. That's it.
That's it. And that's an everyday reality. And we're college educated. My kids are in college. They're private school educated. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when you're dealing with systemic racism and anti-Blackness. In fact, how about this? He might be more of a target. Mm-hmm. God forbid if a cop thinks he's a friggin' uppity Negro.
Yep.
So you can't win for losing. So I'm dealing with life and death potentially, and you're dealing with help me not feel guilty. Mm-hmm. Not my problem. It's not my problem. It's too much work and material out there to read and on YouTube, on Twitter. You educate yourself. Okay? Educate yourself. Because I'm doing double time, triple time, trying to raise a family and have a semblance of peace and safety doing it. And part of that comes from educating my kids on how to deal with cops, you know, or teachers who have unconscious bias, you know. Like it's an everyday thing for me. It's an everyday thing for us. So I'm too busy navigating this, okay? And you want to sit here and talk about racism in America and be kumbaya about it. Kumbaya time is over. It really is. This is life and death. And it's getting worse. Not better. It's getting worse because people are getting caught on camera breaking laws and setting up people or being violent, unnecessarily violent and using brutal force, you know, against, to me, Black people, Black men and women. And you're getting caught on camera now. Okay, so you can't get away with it as much as you used to. And we've reached a critical mass now. That George Floyd video, that was the tipping point. Mm-hmm. And this stuff has got to be addressed, you know, and as we have learned from the January 6th insurrection, a lot of those people were police officers. So it's like we have two sets of laws in this country, one for Black people and one for everybody else, but especially like white people. It's a double standard, and it's just getting more and more dangerous because people, it's like when you're cornered, you come out a little bit more aggressive and violent. And I just feel like this is the cornering of America right now.
Wow. That's incredibly well said. So I want to talk a little bit about what activism looks like to you in your work. And thank you so much for sharing about your family and your experience, because I think that we all have the opportunity to be activists inside of our own homes and what yeah. we're teaching our children, regardless of whether you're white, Black, Native American, Latino, et cetera. Like what we're teaching our children, how we're modeling, how we're preparing them to deal as they go out and interact and bump against the world. There are yeah. so many opportunities for activism in that.
Yeah. Like, because I'm a mom and like, this is not how I set out to raise my kids or set out to live or set out to create a life for them. I'm very much rooted and grounded in love thy neighbor as thyself. Really, it's funny that I'm talking about anti-blackness, but honestly, like, I have great friends that are non-black, and I love them, and there's nothing that I would not do for them. So how I started out was to love others in a way that puts them ahead of you. I mean, that's fundamentally like how I'm wired and designed, is do better than love your neighbor as thyself. It's a scripture that says greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his brother. You know, it's more extraordinary than just treating people like the way you want to be treated. That's how I'm internally wired. It's the concept that God cares for the least among us. So the least among us should be our primary concern. Mm-hmm. So it's just like one of the things that just breaks my heart is just driving around, and it's just the level of homelessness, like here in Los Angeles. And I just know that there is no collective thought or goodwill to solve this problem, because it's not that hard if our collective will was there. Mm-hmm. Like the whole defund the police idea, which, you know, for what it's worth, I'm like, just cut a percent of their budget. You don't have to defund them, like, keep funding them, but they don't need as much as they're doing to not be effective.
Right.
So what if we take a portion of that and use it to solve homelessness? That's the activist mindset that I have. And I'm working towards being a little bit more proactive in that way when I can, you know, when I'm dealing with these four kids, getting them raised and what have you. But I grapple with that a lot. So in my own way, like, what can I do to create space, maybe not a home, but to create space for others who may not have access to the things that I've been privy to, you know? So I'm big on, I purposely took a job teaching like screenwriting, because I feel like whatever I've learned, let me share with others. So that's one way of doing it. But these kids have to pay $30,000 in tuition to do it. And it hit me like, there's some folks who can't afford this. So in my own little way, what I've done is I've created writing workshops and directing workshops. And I have a pay what you can policy.
Oh, wow.
And I do say pay what you can, pay something, because I believe in investing in yourself. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm like, okay, people pay $30,000 for what I'm about to teach you. You just pay what you can. And let me share this knowledge with you and go do great things, you know? So that's like my low-key activism. I mentor a lot of people. I often, when people ask if I can mentor them, I immediately say no, because I'm like, I have four kids. I don't need to take on any more. However, if you have specific questions that you want to ask me, send it in an email and let me get to it. And then I've always established relationships with these people, and they know that they can reach out to me anytime. And I'm here to help them or guide them to the extent that I can. So part of activism for me is a level of accessibility to my talents and sharing of it freely. So I'm always teaching, even as I'm directing. Like, if I have an ear, somebody, I'm always teaching, and I'm always amenable and available. And I just think that, you know, I hope that that's helpful, but that's one way that I do it. And then try to raise my kids up in a way where they can be kind and loving towards others. And it's just really part of who I am and what I do. Now, I don't do anything as a for-profit activist. That's the thing. Like, so there's not spotlights on me doing building, you know. I'm like, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, where I saw firsthand what a community of people do when one person is sick. Like, people are bringing food, people are taking turns, you know, checking in on them, praying for people. Like, it was a very, very hands-on approach. Something's happened with our generation where we're not grounded in community anymore. Mm-hmm. It's like every man for themselves. And I just don't like that. So whatever I can do to ground us in community in a way that I can be of service, I'm doing that. And that is activism every day for me.
Mm-hmm. I love this example too, because it really is about you sharing your gifts and talents with the people who are around you. And, you know, you said there's no spotlights on me. I'm not creating this institute. Like, this is just like day to day where you have space, when you have these interactions, these serendipities, these requests, these people who are hungry for something that you have, where you can model and role model and guide, you know, where they're going and provide them with stuff that maybe they don't have access to otherwise, or you're, you know, a potential point for that content, for that development. And you're open, you're wide open for that. And so people being able to look at your life, where can you do that as well? And that's a beautiful example.
And there's this false notion. And like, we all fall into the trap of it when we're young. And it's like, you know, it's like that prayer to God, like, Lord, if you let me win the lottery, I can do so much. I promise I'll do so much to help others. I'll pay my tithes. I'll do this. And like, you know, when you're young, you're like, okay, if I'm successful and famous, I can use this platform and what have you. And I feel like the opposite is true.
Say more.
It's like, I think fame and success get in the way of, humility-driven activism that is grounded in your divine calling and purpose, no matter who you are. And what happens is, when the fame and success and wealth land on your lap, you're spending more time managing that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have less time to walk in your God-given calling, to love your neighbor as yourself, to exemplify greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his brother. No, instead you're managing materialism and material success, and now capitalism has got a grip on you. But, you know, a lot of people keep up the facade and it's like, I'm for the people, whatever. And it's not, because you have to spend a lot of your time maintaining that status quo.
Right. Instead of doing the real work.
Yeah. But while all of us are called, very few respond. Mm. So that's the reality of it. And you can't sweat it. You got to keep it moving, you know? And everybody has to do what they can, because at the end of the day, we are all accountable. Like, we're all going to die.
Yeah.
And spiritually and biblically speaking, everything that we've amassed in a material sense is going to just burn up. Are you going to leave it? Are you going to leave it for your heirs, or are you going to just squander it, or what have you? So you've lived all this and accumulated all this, and now you're all this. And then at the end of the day, you're going to die, meet your maker. And then what? What? All of that burns away. It's like, ultimately what you do in the privacy of your heart and in agreement with your maker. You know, activism is, you don't let the left hand know what the right hand is doing. You just do the work. That's what's pleasing to God. And ultimately, that's all that really matters to me.
Thank you so much, Christine. This conversation has been, whenever I talk to you, I always just feel enriched by it and by your perspective, and very encouraged as well. So thank you for giving of yourself today. I have one final question for you. For the people out there listening that are sick of talking and want to do something, are ready and aching to jump into this fray, what advice would you give to them as they begin or, reinvigorate their unique activism journey?
So who am I talking to?
We're going to just go ahead and talk directly to our white allies, please. Thank you.
I mean, seriously.
Thank you for that clarification. No, that was important. It was important.
Who am I talking to? I would really embrace what humility means. And if you really dug into what humility means to you, then the answers will become available. You'll see the answers. Mm. The reason why they can't see the answers is because they see themselves first. And humility requires that, again, greater love has no man than to lay down his life for his brothers. What does that look like for you if you had to lay down your life and not put yourself first because your community and culture allows you to do that? What does that look like when you walk in someone else's shoes? Let yourself be humbled by the possibilities of that, and then the answers will come to you. It may cost you something. That's the thing. You may cost you a lot. Are you up for paying that price? And all that does is it just determines who you are and what you're made of. And you may find out that you are indeed racist, and that's most comfortable for you. And if that's the case, it's great to know who you are. Figure out who you are and how you're going to function in this space, in this country, in this world, with that one life that you have. Because it cost our ancestors everything. Sometimes I think about what life they could not live. And in the way that I have my children and they're precious to me. What is it like to have your kids stripped from you or beaten or raped or murdered in front of you? And you have to press on. So examine yourself is what I would say. Examine yourself and be ready for what that calling is. Right. Because if the price is too great, all it has done is revealed who you are. And are you ready to deal with who you are?
Amazing. Thank you so much, Christine. For people who want to follow you, follow your perspective, where can they find more Christine?
Well, I don't like to be followed for my perspective, but if you want to see cute pictures of my puppy, C Swanson 44 on across all platforms. I guess so. I'm not that kind of activist, is my point. It's I don't do activism in my social media. I do activism in my life.
Love it.
So keep doing your good work and keep me posted.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you so much today for today. Right.
My pleasure. This was great. All right, take care.
This episode of the Inclusion First podcast is sponsored by the Social Justice Superhero Academy. In this 4-day online course, you, aspiring changemaker, will learn how to start interrupting racism that is happening around you and start creating more inclusion and more equity in our world. Now, as part of the Academy, you'll get access to 4 1-hour video sessions, an interactive community space to share experiences and ask questions, workbooks, exercises, and guides to support you on your journey. Enrollment closes in early August, so sign up today at www.tinyurl.com/social-justice-superhero. Thank you for listening to the Inclusion First podcast.
We are always collecting and answering your most important questions on anti-racism. So if there's something on your mind, head on over to theinclusionfirstproject.org and click on Ask a Question. We'd love for you to give us your like, your share, your follow, and especially your review, wherever you find us. Thank you so much again for listening, and we will talk to you next time.